members of the jury, I would like in this second session to look at the record of the General Assembly and to ask whether the Assembly cannot use the powers that it actually has to the full in the matter of Palestine. We know that, so I would like to look at the responsibility of the General Assembly, and then I will turn to the international law developments in terms of accountability of international organizations. The General Assembly, there are a lot of misconceptions about the General Assembly. It is often said that it can only make recommendations, but one forgets that it can also authorize. In other words, it can set the basis for states who are willing to take measures to act without appearing to act illegally or illegitimately. So it has the power to authorize, and it has, of course, internal powers, the powers to set up subsidiary organs of the General Assembly, which I will also come to. And the General Assembly has not hesitated in the past, when faced with the paralysis of the Security Council, to assert its secondary responsibility. It is often said, and the court has said it, that the Security Council has a primary responsibility in the field of peace and security, but that that is not an exclusive responsibility, that the General Assembly has a residual or secondary responsibility in the field of peace and security. The General Assembly also has vast powers under the Charter, under Article 10, to in fact deal with any question under the Charter, any question. In other words, it can range from peace and security matters to decolonization to economic and social issues and so on. So it has a very wide competence indeed. Now, first, the General Assembly has utilized on numerous occasions, particularly on the Middle East, the Uniting for Peace Resolution, Resolution 377, which allows it to transfer a question from the Security Council to the General Assembly when that body has failed to exercise its primary responsibility. And this has been taken to mean that it is blocked or paralyzed by a veto. It has in the past, so I'm looking at what it actually has done on other issues. It has in the past adopted several resolutions recommending to member states the adoption of economic sanctions, notably in the cases of South Africa and Portuguese territories. But more importantly, in 1982, and that has been forgotten, it called for financial and diplomatic sanctions against Israel in a resolution relating to the Golan Heights. It, of course, also established the first peacekeeping mission, the first and only large peacekeeping mission in Suez. And at that time, it was challenged by the Soviet Union and by France, but ultimately, the International Court of Justice accepted that it had acted legally in so doing. Now, under the Uniting for Peace resolution, it can even in theory, one forgets that, it is in this resolution, it can also authorize or recommend, rather, the use of force. Not that I think that this would, this has never been utilized, and not that I think that it would be very practical or advisable, but I'm saying this is within its power, so long as it recommends. It has established fact-finding missions, of course, to complement those of the Human Rights Council. It has rejected the credentials of illegitimate governments. And this is another power at its disposal. In 1974, it rejected the credentials of the South African delegation on the grounds of that government's apartheid policies. And hence, the South African delegation was unable to participate in the work of the General Assembly. Now, there was a lot of debate about that, the legality of what the Assembly had done. And the president of the Assembly justified this measure by saying that the problem of apartheid and occupation of Namibia had been before the General Assembly for more than 25 years, that no other country had so flagrantly institutionalized a system of racial and ethnic bias, that it had flouted General Assembly and Security Council action, as well as the ICJ, and that the General Assembly had an undeniable responsibility for the people of the territory. Now, if you can consider that, as I've said, Palestine had an international status akin to that of Namibia as a former mandate. And also, the General Assembly took the initiative to establish a mixed internal international tribunal in Cambodia. Professor Falk has said nothing can stop the Assembly from establishing such a tribunal, although I don't think it would be very practical. But legally speaking, it does not lack the power to establish a judicial body. The International Court of Justice has also confirmed this in regard to the administrative tribunal. It said the Assembly is not a judicial body, but it can establish judicial bodies in order to carry out its functions. And of course, the Assembly, and this is something I have urged but nobody seems interested in, two advisory opinions were asked by ECOSOC, authorized by the General Assembly, regarding the violations of the immunity of its experts on mission. There was a Mr. Kumaraswamy, a Mr. Mazilu, whose immunities had not been respected by the host states. And you see that the General Assembly does not react when Professor Richard Falk had his immunities flagrantly violated, and under the Convention on Privileges and Immunities, the court would be bound to give an opinion on this. The court also, in the Wall case, did much to bolster the role of the General Assembly. It confirmed the legality of Uniting for Peace. It confirmed the legality of what was called the rolling sessions. In other words, on the same transfer of the question, the 10th Emergency Special Session was reconvened for the 11th time to consider the question of the wall. And Israel contested that, although it did not contest Uniting for Peace. Israel has accepted that the Assembly can use Uniting for Peace. But it did challenge the rolling session, the reconvening all the time of these extraordinary sessions. The court said, this is perfectly all right. So we see that the court has played a tremendous role, and in bolstering that role of the Assembly, and the ICJ stressed that, and I quote, there has been an increasing tendency over time for the General Assembly and the Security Council to deal in parallel with the same matter concerning the maintenance of international peace and security. Despite certain express restrictions in the Charter, I won't bore you with the legal details, but there are limitations on the Assembly's use of its powers while the Council is addressing a question. And the court said, in practice, these limitations have been undermined and practically no longer applicable. So it's really widened that competence. And it said, moreover, not only does the Assembly's competence extend to matters of peace and security, which is undeniably the question of Palestine, but that it has the unique vantage point, unlike the Security Council, to address such matters also from a broader humanitarian, social, and economic perspective. Sorry, I've mixed up all my pages. Where is page 24? Never mind. Right. So you can see that the Assembly really has a tremendous, number of powers which it can exercise. Now, remember that the ICJ did call on the Assembly and the Security Council to take such further action to bring to an end the illegal situation. The Goldstone Report also addressed its recommendations to the General Assembly, requesting the Security Council to report to the General Assembly on measures taken to ensure the accountability of Israel for its military operations in Gaza. And it's forgotten that, in fact, under the Charter, the General Assembly shall receive and consider not only annual reports from the Security Council, but also special reports, it is they called, accounting for the measures that the Council has taken to maintain international peace and security. So these are the kinds of accountability measures that the General Assembly can call on the Assembly to take. Unfortunately, although it has requested special report, very, very on occasion, really a very few occasions, it has not really taken the trouble to make comments on the way the council had handled particular issues. So this is really a tool for accountability. The Goldstone report also recommended that the General Assembly consider whether additional action within its powers is required in the interests of justice to promote an urgent discussion also on the legality of the use of certain munitions which were used in the Gaza operation. So there is the court, there is the Goldstone report addressing specific particular requests to the General Assembly, which it can obviously take up, which fall within its competence. But the follow-up of the Assembly to all these demands was a very watered-down series of resolutions, particularly due to the fact that it had to muster the support of certain Western nations, and here the European Union is also very much at fault, because they had opposed the request for an advisory opinion. The European Union, in fact, played a very peculiar game. The European Union members voted for a resolution in the General Assembly which stated the illegality of the construction of the wall under international law. But when the next resolution called for an advisory opinion in order to see what the legal consequences of that illegality would be, the European Union abstained on the grounds that this was a political issue, not a legal one. And the court has rejected this distinction between political and legal. What it has said is every question, there are no questions that are purely political, there are no questions that are purely legal. Every political question has underlying legal issues. And it said, we, the court, can look at the legal aspects, the Security Council can look at the political aspects of that situation. So anyway, as I've said, the Assembly watered down these resolutions. In July 2004, the Assembly adopted a resolution which only acknowledges the advisory opinion. The wording was watered down to acknowledges. It did reiterate its usual demands on Israel, but it did not consider the means of ensuring compliance. What means? I only choose two things that the Assembly called for in its resolutions, only to show that they did not go far enough. One was the register of damages. Now, the International Court of Justice had done something extremely important. It had called in an unprecedented move on the part of the court. It had called for reparations, or at least by declaring that the construction of the wall by Israel was illegal. It then called for compensation, or reparations for this illegality, for all material damages, in other words, to individuals, for material damage caused by the construction of the wall, the destruction of orchards and so on, the displacement of populations. So the Assembly decided to follow up by establishing a register of damages caused to all natural or legal persons concerned from the seizure and destruction of homes, land, and property as a result of the construction of the wall. Now, it took 2.5 years for the Secretary General to come up with a scheme. When we compare this to the rapidity with which the UNCC, the UN Compensation Commission scheme, came up, you can understand the frustrations. And the register was just an electronic database established in Vienna, which is a far cry from a compensation commission. It merely receives, processes, and reviews claims which are established for all these damages, but does nothing more about them. It doesn't have any criteria for the types of damages, nor any criteria for the kinds of compensation matched to the damages, which is something that the governing council of the UN Compensation Commission spent weeks in debating and actually produced rules and regulations on this. The General Assembly also missed the opportunity to widen the scope and function of the Register of Damages following on the Gaza operation, which would have made so much sense, in fact, not even the reception of claims. The Goldstone report recommended that the General Assembly establish an escrow fund to be used to pay adequate compensation to Palestinians who have suffered loss or damage. There was no follow-up to this suggestion. Another example, and of course I don't have time to give you too many, but another example is that of Switzerland as the high, as the depository of the Geneva Conventions. Now, the court had called on all the high contracting parties to the Geneva Convention under common Article 1 of the four conventions, which call on the parties, in fact, to respect and to ensure the application of the convention. And this has been interpreted as meaning that member states have an obligation under the conventions to make sure that other states are respecting these conventions and to take measures. The court had therefore called on the high contracting parties, the General Assembly, so to take measures to ensure the respect of Israel for the Geneva Conventions. The General Assembly specifically called on Switzerland as the depository of the conventions and called on it to resume a conference of high contracting parties to debate on that particular question. What happened was that Switzerland merely produced a report which said, we're very sorry, but we acknowledge the failure of our diplomatic efforts to get the high contracting parties together. And this was presented to the President of the General Assembly, and of course there was no further follow-up. So there are certain areas where the General Assembly could have done so much in the follow-up to the advisory opinion and has not done that. I wanted to say something about statehood, but I won't go through that, as Professor Quigley has so well discussed the situation. I simply want to say that, first of all, in terms of procedure, although the court did rule that both organs were required to admit new members to the UN in 1950, one judge put forward the view that though the exercise of the right of veto by the permanent members was clear if you took the charter literally, but that the General Assembly was entitled, because of the need for universality of the organization, was entitled to ask the Council for what reason it failed to recommend a state for admission, but also to determine whether or not this right of veto has been abused. And indeed, as I've said, the UN after the Cold War freeze aimed for universality. It admitted states which emerged from the decolonization process on the grounds of their legitimacy, in some cases overriding the criteria of effectiveness. For example, Guinea-Bissau, even while it was still under Portuguese occupation, Namibia was admitted to membership of the ILO on the basis that its legitimate rights should not be frustrated by the illegal occupation of South Africa. And by the way, it will be recalled that the Security Council even admitted a state without a name to the United Nations. That's how far sometimes they're willing to go, and that was Macedonia. It simply said, we admit the state referred to in document S/57, whatever it is, to membership. Moreover, the court has recognized the discretionary right of the Assembly to determine the forms and procedures by which the right to self-determination of territories over which it exercised responsibility was to be realized. And that was in the case of Western Sahara. Now, the General Assembly did recognize the legitimacy of the unilateral declaration of Palestinian statehood back in 1988. So there is no doubt that this was in line with Resolution 181. So we come, you know, I've tried to draw a panorama of everything the UN has done barring Palestine, to ask the question whether we can speak of responsibility in a narrow legal sense. In other words, as the legal consequence which ensures from the commission of an internationally wrongful act. Can the failings of the UN be viewed in such a context? Now, I want to tell you that accountability of international organizations has become a very important part of the process in international law of introducing the rule of law into international relations. And the General Assembly adopted articles on responsibility of international organizations, which was drawn up by the International Law Commission, which is the body established under the General Assembly to develop and codify international law. And Article 3 states, every internationally wrongful act of an international organization entails the international responsibility of the international organization, providing the act is the act of the IO, it's attributable to it, and constitutes a breach of its international obligations. Now, you may think this is just theoretical, but in fact, there's been a number of case law now in at the regional level, particularly the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice under the European Union, which have in fact been dealing with exactly this issue. What happens when, but in the context of terrorism, in the context of the Security Council's freezing of the funds of terrorists. And they have raised the issue of the accountability of the Security Council and of the member states. Because these draft articles not only talk about responsibility of IOs, but talk about the responsibility of the member states for the conduct of the IO, and the responsibility of the IO for the conduct of its members. There is a relationship here. And there could be dual or even multiple attribution of conduct, as a court in The Hague, which had the case of Srebrenica, raised, in fact, the question whether both the UN peacekeeping forces and the peacekeeping forces itself, in other words, the Netherlands, had dual responsibility for Srebrenica. Now, the question that arises, however, it's not all that simple, of course, and the question that arises is whether one can hold the Council accountable not for positive conduct, but for failure to act. Now, theoretically, those articles talk about the conduct, the wrongful act, as being both acts and omissions. So here there is room for at least thinking about this. We know very well that its voting procedures lawfully prevent it from taking action because the veto is part of the charter procedures. But the special rapporteur of this, these articles on responsibility of IOs, referring to the omissions of the UN in Rwanda, said failure to act on the part of the UN would represent a breach of an international obligation. Difficulties relating to the decision-making process could not exonerate the United Nations. So accountability issues have been faced by the UN. They've established investigations into Rwanda and Srebrenica. And the Secretary General expressed the mea culpa of the UN, saying the international community as a whole must accept its share of responsibility for allowing this tragic course of events. This responsibility is shared by the Security Council, the contact group, and other governments. So, although in practice this is not easy to apply accountability to international organizations, and there is no court before which one can bring the UN, because there is no international tribunal to judge its acts, and in domestic law the United Nations has immunity, so it's very difficult. Nevertheless, it's a process that had been set in motion. And at least the principle of accountability, which is extremely new, has been put on the agenda of the international organizations. Now, if we look at the voting procedures in the Security Council, it's very interesting. There is a clause in the Charter that extracts from the UN Charter domestic matters, matters of domestic jurisdiction. Now, we know, and the veto is the same thing. It extracts from the UN any matter which involves a big power or one of its clients. But over the years, the clause on domestic jurisdiction has been totally whittled down because of course, the whole human rights movement and the fact that now human rights is no longer of domestic jurisdiction. And it seems to me, and it has been raised in international fora, whether in fact the sphere of big power, domaine réservé, should not be whittled down as well in the light of developments in international relations and law. And there has been calls, well, there have been calls, of course, for the abolition of the veto. I think that is very difficult, and obviously because the veto can apply to the abolishing the veto. But at the same time, and also it is useful in some, on some occasions. It is useful to prevent the UN from going into areas which it should not go into. One remembers the whole debate on Iraq, whether there should be a resolution authorizing the US to go into Iraq. However, there should be some form of auto-restraint on the part of the permanent members when fundamental community values are at stake in exercising their veto powers. And there has been a call on the permanent members not to use their vetoes when fundamental norms which concern the international community as a whole are concerned. And later, maybe I can address that in the questions. This is the way reform at the UN has gone. It's not gone through formal amendments. There have been only two amendments in the history of the Charter, and they've only related to numerical expansion of the Security Council membership and ECOSOC. But the UN is a very different organization from what it was in the past. And if you think about the way the Security Council has gone from, is that 1 minute or is that 3 minutes? The way the Security Council has been pressured by the reports by UNICEF, by WHO on infant mortality in Iraq, it's been pressured to abandon comprehensive sanctions and to move to targeted sanctions. And then there was the challenge of targeted sanctions without due process, freezing the funds of individuals without due process. And this pressure, as I've told you, led to a case law before the European courts in particular. The latest one is a decision on NADA, which involved finding Switzerland, it was on the question of the Swiss application of Security Council sanctions, the NADA case. So there have been pressures to move from comprehensive sanctions to targeted sanctions, and then pressures for not doing targeted sanctions in the right way, which has led the Council, with the permanent members constantly opposing and dragging their feet. Nevertheless, they felt that they were being, overridden by the Strasbourg courts and by the European courts into at least appointing an ombudsman to review Security Council decisions. It's not much, it's not a court, but we can see how, it's incremental pressure, and this has changed the face of sanctions. Also thanks, I may say, to Switzerland and other like-minded states who were the ones to propose all these measures. So let me conclude. The fact that Palestine is a territory with an international status and therefore of international concern has several implications, as we have seen. Palestine is a threat to the peace. Threat to the peace means also redefining what is a threat. There's the concept of human security, the concept of rule of law. And the UN, in particular the Assembly and the Security Council, are under an obligation. The international law outside the Charter also applies to the United Nations. In other words, the UN, the Council, is bound, for example, by these peremptory norms of international law, which include self-determination. And that's the courts that have confirmed this, that there are limits to the actions of the Security Council under international law. There are such concepts as responsibility to protect, and this must mean that a veto that obstructs action, as I've said, directed to the protection of vital community values and interests, must be considered to lack legitimacy. It can also be seen under international law as an abuse of rights, a matter of not good faith. Because even if you are legally entitled for a veto, if you abuse that right for purposes for which it was not meant, this is also an illegal act under international law. I've said also that that resolution must take place within a collective UN framework, and it's not a matter bilateral, trilateral, or for the quartet. And Professor Dugard has signaled his perplexity with the quartet, which is curiously composed of the UN on par with its member states. The UN cannot shelve its responsibility in this way, and it cannot accept a roadmap drawn up by an American president when there is a United Nations roadmap on the record. So finally, to conclude my last words, we can see how the double standards in the case of Palestine stand out in stark contrast to the enforcement action taken by the Council and other similar types of occupation of territory. And such double standards in collective responses to breaches of fundamental norms of international law of concern to the international community as a whole, and in respect of a territory for which the UN continues to have a special responsibility, endangers the principle of the rule of law in international affairs, on which the legitimacy and the authority of the organization depends. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Garland-Devis. I have a number of questions, but I'm going to ask Michael Mansfield to put a question initially.
Yes, there are two rather waiting for it to calm down. Two separate questions. The first relates to the accountability of the United Nations itself, that last point you were making. Although there's no court for the accountability to be, as it were, registered. But I just want to ask you about a recent, took place I think 3 weeks ago. It's the first time it's ever happened. The General Assembly proposed a declaration. And the declaration was about the rule of law, because they realized the extent to which the rule of law was being undermined all over the world by different regimes for different reasons. And many nations attended this declaration. Conspicuous for their absence was, in fact, Israel and the United Kingdom. And they pledged, many nations pledged, to make improvements in the application of the rule of law within their own territories. Again, first time that that has happened. But conspicuous from the debate in its absence was any criticism of the United Nations itself not upholding the rule of law. So it hardly behoves the General Assembly to ask everyone to do that if they're not going to do it themselves. Now, that's the first question, if you'd like to comment on that.
Yes, certainly. The rule of law has been applied by international organizations, whether it's the United Nations, the European Union, in other countries. In other words, interestingly, it's imported the rule of law concept from the domestic arena, because, of course, it's a constitutional concept. It's imported it into the international sphere and then re-exported it back into the domestic systems. And it is also very noticeable in UN international administrations, for example, in Kosovo, where the UN had established a presence there with vast legislative, executive, and judicial powers. Rule of law was central, and there are several plans by the World Bank and so on for rule of law. And rule of law figures also in the summit declaration. I forget what it's called now. My head's a blank. The outcome document from that summit in 2005. Rule of law figures prominently. But as you said, the question of the rule of law has to begin, with the international organizations. And this is exactly what these articles from the International Law Commission are there to address, because they talk about accountability, which is a very important part of rule of law.
Well, the second question links to that, and that is accountability in relation to the Wall judgment that I read out this morning. So the court says, back to you, General Assembly and Security Council, they do nothing. Now, you've said, interestingly, there are a whole range, I'm going away from the Security Council of the General Assembly, there are a whole range of accountability measures. But if you transfer from the International Court back to the United Nations, on the ground, how's this going to happen? In other words, the court says it's over to you, and the General Assembly, who activates these accountability measures? I'm a Palestinian, if you know what I mean, and I want action. So how do I get it? How do I get the General Assembly to go beyond a few data reparation accounts in Geneva? That's the real question. That's what Palestinians want to know. How do they do it?
Now, this is, of course, a political question, because
I know that.
It's not a legal question, because in legal terms, I have tried to outline that the Assembly could have taken much more...
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm going to pursue it. Yeah. I know that what the General Assembly can do, but they're not going to do it unless somebody says, hey, do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm saying, how does the Palestinian get to the hey, do it stage? It's a legal question and a political one, and this is where we're at the crossroads.
Well, first of all, the Palestinians should have taken the wall opinion much further.
Right. Well, that's
it was forgotten for a number of years and not pressed. There were a number of moves that the Palestinians could have done.
You mean the Palestinian Authority? Sorry.
Authority. To keep this alive. There are also a number of moves within the General Assembly to lobby sufficient number of states to adopt measures. But even measures which would have been difficult to reject, I've mentioned, for example, they're small measures, but nevertheless they're symbolic. Even the question of asking the International Court of Justice to pronounce on the Convention on Privileges and Immunities, I have tried to push this. And this would have meant simply lobbying a number of states, and it would have been very difficult for states to say there is no convention, there are no rules on immunity. The convention is there, and the Assembly has the obligation to protect its experts on mission. Now, this was not done. So that's what I mean by a political question. It's a question of lobbying, of getting, of deciding, first of all, what the Assembly can do, and then trying to get the backing in order to get a resolution through. Unfortunately, in international law, someone said this morning that it's the member states, it's not the UN. In law, the UN has a separate legal personality. We all know that it's not the UN. We all know that it's not the Security Council doing things, but one permanent member or two permanent members. But nevertheless, in international law accountability, the Security Council acts are attributable to the United Nations as a separate legal entity. So we work with fictions. It's like a state. What is a state? The people behind it, it's the governments. But nevertheless, we work on the basis of state entities.
Garland Devis, I would like to follow up by asking a question about an organ of the United Nations that you have not mentioned, and that is the Secretary General. Do you think the Secretary General could do more? My impression is that in recent years, the only occasion on which the Secretary General has taken an initiative in respect of the Palestinian issue was when he appointed a fact-finding mission to override the fact-finding mission established by the Human Rights Council. But do you think that there's a role for the Secretary General and that he has in the past failed to exercise that role?
Certainly. The Secretary General has quite a number of powers which are not expressly stipulated in the Charter. Some of them are, of course, but some of them have been brought about in the practice of the United Nations. And that has very much depended on personalities and whether the Secretary General is willing to stick his neck out, as some very brilliant Secretary Generals have done, like Doug Hammarskjöld, for example. In order to act. Now, the Secretary General has the same power as a member state under Article 99 to bring to the attention of the Security Council a situation which is threatening international peace and security. This is the same power granted to a member state. Now, the Secretary Generals have said, well, to do that, we have to look at the situations. We have to establish good offices. We have to send emissaries. So there's a whole work that can be done before the Secretary General, by the way, they've only done that twice, I think, or three times, very few times. But there's a whole work before that which allows the Secretary General to determine for himself, or herself, hopefully, in the future, whether a situation is worth bringing to the attention of the Council. It's on the initiative I've mentioned of the Secretary General's, sorry, the Security Council has hidden behind the Secretary General in fact-finding. It's been the initiative of the Secretary General's to establish fact-finding. Now, what the Secretary General does with the fact-finding is, of course, dependent on the courage of the Secretary General. For example, as I mentioned, the Ian Martin report, which determined, by the way, it's very interesting, that Israel had to pay compensation for the UN buildings and schools which were destroyed. And Israel agreed in principle to pay that compensation. I don't know if it has actually been forthcoming or not, but it has agreed in principle to pay it. That's remarkable, okay? That's the first time that Israel accepts to pay a sum of compensation. But for what? For the destruction of UN buildings and schools, and it's a very small sum. So it's up to the Secretary General. I think the Secretary General has a lot of powers, but I think it's how he exercises that's the key. Also, I think that when the court calls on the UN organs, it is also calling on all the organs, including the Secretary General, and surely the Secretary General also has responsibility.
Thank you very much. Yes, one last question.
Thank you for your presentation. I would like to ask, could you discuss the potential use and benefits of the Uniting for Peace resolution and the beneficial ways in which the Palestinians can use this?
Certainly. As I've said before, it's been used frequently for the Middle East. For example, the first peacekeeping force was established because the Security Council could not agree on the invasion of Suez. The invasion following on the Suez crisis. In fact, it was first created under the Korean, during the Korean crisis. So it has been used in the Middle East for peacekeeping. It's also been used for the Palestinian question. But what can the Assembly do under Uniting for Peace is, of course, constrained by the resolution itself. It does say that the General Assembly can determine there is a threat to the peace, that there is an act of aggression. Now, that's a great thing. I mean, that is a real determination. It can also, as I've said, it established a committee to recommend collective action, which has never been used. So the Uniting for Peace has not been used to the hilt. It's been used only as a procedural mechanism to transfer questions from the Security Council to the General Assembly. But certainly the Palestinians have made use of it. For example, the wall case was on the basis of the Uniting for Peace.
Well, thank you very much for that very broad overview of the United Nations and what it could do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.